Welcome to Behind the Axle. This is a podcast that will take a look at what is going on in the world of wheelchair rugby. We will take a look at the topics and issues that are of concern to the players, coaches, staffs, referees, and classifiers of our league from coast to coast. We hope that you will join me, Mike Klinowski, Dave Mengen, and Hall of Famer Chris Cook as we discuss what is going on in our great sport today. Hey folks, it's a beautiful Sunday afternoon. I'm here in Chicago. I've got some friends with me. We've got Dave Mengen, Chris Cook, and our wonderful guest, Eric Chase, is hailing from Michigan as well. So let's talk about rugby today, guys. It's been a while since we've seen the court.
Way too long.
Way too long. And let's talk about some things because we miss it, and we need something to fill that hole in our souls right now. So Eric, welcome to the party. Thank you so much for coming on in on a Sunday where we're mostly not drinking, but some of us are on Bloody Mary number 3, but, hopefully it'll lead to good conversations. Looking forward to talking to you about the past, the present and the future.
Guys, thanks for asking me, to be a part of this.
Thank you for being here, man.
Been around rugby a long time. Yeah, been around rugby a long time.
When did you start? Remember? I remember you coming to practice like once a year and thinking, man, that kid's got some potential, but he doesn't show up. Get him back. Your wingspan, that was what impressed me at first, was your wingspan.
Yeah, well, it was hard to get out of the, you know, when you're going to college full time and having fun and trying to commit to rugby. I know it was something that I always wanted to do, but it was, I just had to grow up probably like all of us, but, no,
is that supposed to happen again?
Yeah. Still working on it. I'll give you the whole scenario. I mean, I got hurt in 2003, became a quadriplegic in August,
What's your injury? How'd you get there?
People don't know. Yeah, I was riding a dirt bike and hit a small jump, landed wrong, and did some somersaults and just woke up laying on my back. My friends were there. They watched me do it. All of us, obviously, besides Mike, experienced this, but weird feeling. You know, at 17 years old, I had no idea, you know, what paralysis actually meant or how it would feel. But I knew it wasn't right. And I was in Mary Free bed for 3 months. I had a halo on, similar to what Dave had. And, you know, my initial goal was to walk again. I mean, that, you know, being 17 and not knowing any better. But I was a junior, made it to high school. I was a basketball, football, baseball player before my injury. And really enjoyed sports. I would suppose I had an athlete mind for the game, but I still stayed a part of my basketball and football teams, so that was a lot of fun.
In high school? Yeah.
Yes. Yep. My high school, I lived in a rural area, and I was more or less the guinea pig for having a disability in my high school. You know, they accommodated me pretty well, set me up with everything I need, very relaxed on my therapy requirements and my function level to be able to either type or write as I was still learning. As an active dominant athlete in high school, returning in a wheelchair and a halo, I mean, you know, getting everyone staring at you, you know, I still had the same friends as I did, but you know, it's a different scene. It's a hard thing to adjust to when you're at that age. For anybody, really, but you know, good support system, good family, good friends, and good attitude. You know, I guess you can push your way through it. But
did you choose MSU because it was close to home?
I did, and I also chose it because I had the agricultural program. I grew up in a rural community. My uncle is a dairy farmer. I love being around the farm, and that was my kind of my goal was to do something in the agricultural field. So I went to
MSU. MSU is accessibility wise.
I went there in 2006, and at that point they were ripping up all the sidewalks, putting in heated sidewalks all over the campus, which was really cool.
That's real cool.
But the campus, if anybody's been there, you know, it's 2.5 miles, 3 miles from one end to the other.
Spread out, yeah.
So I drove to every class, which was nice. You know, I lived on my own at that time too. That's when I moved out, moved in with a roommate. And from there I was still doing, you know, therapy, but I also, between high school and Michigan State, I had that stem cell surgery in 2005 in Portugal. So that was a experimental thing that we raised money for. I never seen any positive.
Is that the olfactory nerve one?
Yes.
Yep. Lima. It was Dr. Lima.
Yes. Yep.
Who actually passed away, I don't know how long ago, but.
Yeah, a year or two ago, I heard that.
Yeah.
I never had any contact with him in the last 10 years. So, I mean, but, you know, more along in the story, I'll get to, you know, the side effects of that surgery, what's inhibiting my life and quad rugby now. I guess it's, you know, becoming a negative effect of the pain that they say is coming from that surgery.
Do you have a syrinx? You're not losing function at all, are you?
For a while there, I lost a little bit of feeling in my left hand and the pain level in my neck, which probably contributed to a lot of rugby and training, not enough rest. But there's like polyps that have grown in my spinal columns. And when they get agitated and irritable, they grow, from what I've been told. And then it puts pressure on my spinal cord, and a lot of pain comes with that. And I started experiencing that towards the end of my USA career, and still deal with it on and off now. So,
I've known a thing.
They don't know. They don't want to do surgery. They don't want to do radiation. And beyond that, it's just pain tolerance and management, I guess. But
so how'd you end up finding rugby?
Doing therapy. Dave Menjen's team, the Michigan Storm, back in 2007, I believe it was, did a demo expo at my gym that I worked out at. And him and Nick.
Grand Rapids, right?
Yeah,
I remember that. Yep. I actually have pictures from that event, and I forgot that you were there. Because then we didn't see you again for quite a while.
Yeah, it was quite a while until I came back in the scene. But that's kind of what that demo definitely made me hungry for the sport that I was, you know, earning for. You know, driving. I lived on the other side of the state from you guys too, which was a challenge to get to practices. But so that was 2007, I guess, was my first time I sat in a chair. And then in 2008 and 9 was my first rugby season with you guys. That's the year that I cheered and retired, and I kind of got some notes on that year. That's the first year I seen Chuck Aoki the first time playing at Delta College, doing somersaults.
We called him Chuck back then, right? Because he was puking in a bucket all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, he would push until he threw up.
Yeah,
every time I saw him, I swear.
No way.
yeah. He was just super intense, but his body just wasn't ready for it, I don't think. And you could see the kid was going to be good if he could get his body to stay up to his mental push, man. I mean, he just was nonstop out there. It was crazy. But yeah, that was really early on.
Yeah. that first season too, I remember, coming in to watch Kirkland and Scaturo and Chance and Aoki all play in the Heartland sectional that we hosted, the Michigan team hosted. And, you know, seeing those guys out there just obviously I wanted to get better and try to reach that level. But
and they were the B team.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, the first time I saw you play, Eric, the first thing I noticed was, whoa, he's deceptively taller and longer than he looks in his chair. And I remember there was one specific thing. It was an inbounds pass. And all of a sudden, you came up like a crane out of nowhere and just grabbed the ball out of midair when it was going to go right over you. I was like, dude, he's long. And this was when I first, you know, met you in, I guess it was the Renegades. I'm not sure. It was in 2011 or 12, whenever that was. Mm-hmm. But I thought, wow, this guy's got potential. And yeah, and that's where it started for me.
Yeah, the love affair with Eric Chase.
That's when Cook started to really enjoy rugby.
Yeah. Jeez. I guess having long arms is definitely a positive thing to have. Yeah, it's.
I learned a long time ago not to pass over you.
Yeah,
that exactly. Reaching is my downfall. I reach too much. That's
Who here doesn't reach too much? Cook, do you reach or do you go for possession?
Well, but Eric's improved there, though. He used to just reach at everything.
Yeah.
And now he's much more strategic about it. Even when he's doing it in the backcourt, it's because he's got an advantage there or because we're in a desperate situation. Those are our two opportunities, right? So
yeah.
I find it's been pretty effective more recently. Like, you know, when he goes after it, we get the ball a higher percentage than I would have expected. Man. Certainly earlier in your career, when I was always yelling at you not to reach.
Like, I mean, in tight game situations, I've noticed, you know, when you're going point for point, and you're longing for that turnover. If you can't get chair position and create a turnover by having them throw a bad pass, obviously reaching for the ball, bouncing it off their chair, popping it up and making them touch it so it goes out of bounds, that can change the momentum of the game in 10 seconds. I mean, you can be back on top. There's been many games that I've played that have came out in our favor because of that, but it doesn't always work, but certain situations.
So before we start about USA stuff, I have a question for you. So
yeah.
What was like, so you're talking about like pivotal moments in a game. What was the greatest game you've ever been involved with where it was just like moments like that, where it's just like it all came to that one moment, you were there for it, and you're part of something really special. Like, you know, bottom of the ninth, down by three sort of situation. Where...
Oh, you know, I wish I would have wrote this down when this game happened. There's been several that I can think of, but the most vivid memories that is your explanation that this fits, I guess. I would say there's two of them. One in Chicago, I believe it was, when we played in Minnesota, four or five overtimes. We end up winning the game.
Iron Man.
The next one, I remember better is Dave, myself, Adam, Kavanaugh, our 1-5, and Andy Zimmer playing in, I think it was Jacksonville Day.
Yeah.
Versus
I was there.
Germany.
And a couple of you guys were sick. Like, you were sick.
Andy. I had a horrible sinus infection. I couldn't breathe. We played Germany's
Swiss
development squad.
It was a Swiss team.
Swiss. Oh. Anyways, we battled them until it was dark out. Everybody left the court.
Four OTs.
Four more times we came out on top.
Nice.
There was many instances in that game that reaching or hitting them over bounds.
Especially in OT, right?
Yeah.
Like there was, I remember at the end of one of the OTs, we were up and we thought we had it. And somebody intercepted a pass and crossed the line just as the buzzer went. It's like, now we got to do this again. It's like we had all these opportunities. But those are fun times, man. Those like four overtime games, they're brutal, but super fun.
Without subbing, overcoming all those challenges, you know, those are
We didn't have a sub. There was only four.
But yeah, those were good times for sure.
So let's jump into USA. So you were with the USA program between 2010, 2012?
Yeah, I tried out for Team Force in 2011, end of 2011.
Okay.
Troy and Sue were the coach at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Mountain, Schockenbauer, Landon, Butler, Zimmer, Emily, CJ, Jeremy Brown. Those are the only ones I can remember. I think there was a couple more was on that squad. And that's when our Force squad was training next to the USA team. I mean, what a great experience to be able to either get into a grinder versus the USA squad. You know, being apart, watching all those athletes, especially those twos at that time, which I am a 2.0, that, you know, to learn from. So, yeah, I was a Team Force for a year, and then I tried out for the national team.
Was Troy your coach in Team Force?
Yes. Yep. I learned a lot from him. I owe a lot to Troy, actually. He was he believed in me. He brought things out of me that other coaches never did. And I would say Troy is one of my biggest mentors and developing coaches I've ever had, for sure.
Yep. I would agree. He's awesome. I got to play with him 1 year, and we went D1, and we had Garrett Hickling on the team along with Troy. We ran a high-low, and about midway through a game, it was really funny. It was real tight, and Troy just took over. He took over the game, and that, you know, it's hard to do with Garrett on the team too, right? But it was awesome to watch. And then he took over the huddles too. And I thought, you should be a coach, bro. And he goes, oh, maybe someday. And you know what the history is from then.
Yeah.
So with that time with USA, who was your like 2.0 crush? Like, who did you want to be like? Who did you like look at to mimic and to base your skills off of?
Sure. Great question. Hands down, Will Grew. Obviously. I mean, I remember sitting in the chair next to him and Gumby both looking at our arms and wingspan. And our hands are dragging on the ground, both of us. And you know, that was probably an asset with Grew retiring in the future, having somebody to fill his spot. But obviously, those are huge, huge shoes to fill that unfortunately I didn't get to take on. But you know, he was definitely watching him on the court, his leadership skills, thinking one or two plays ahead of the next player. I'm watching him take a hit as well. I mean, his hand placements on taking a hit, so his wheels didn't spin, and his where his weight was, where he positioned his body, taking hits. A lot of things came from him, obviously. So
And
truthfully, Eric, we reached out to him and he wouldn't come on. That's why you're on this show.
Yeah.
Be fair, I don't think we ever got a response from
him. Here's the thing about Will is that I've only had a limited amount of time hanging out with him, but I was there for USA tryouts for Lima a few years back. And he's just a smart, smart, smart man. And he obviously like focuses on the right areas. Like he may train hard, but he does it smartly too.
Smart.
And I would just listen to him rattle things off. And I'm just like, how am I in the same room with this man? Like, it's just like, I hang out with you guys and you guys are nice enough to dumb it down for me, but Will was just like talking at another level. And I'm like, I hope that if I sit close enough to him while he's talking, I might get a little smarter. But it obviously didn't work, so I'll have to try again.
Like the Blarney Stone.
I reached out to Will probably in 2012. Maybe it was when I just started Force. And, we all know it takes a long time for your body to morph into the rugby game, your shoulders and your arms and your endurance level. And, you know, I thought I was training enough, but I reached out to him and I was like, I can't, I'm getting tired. My body's not keeping up. My shoulders hurt. And, you know, he just kept instilling in my brain that it takes a long time to get there, but also training the right way, utilizing what's available to you. And, you know, his word spoke pretty highly to me at that point.
So where did you compete when you were on USA?
So when after I got on USA team, that's exactly when they announced the probably three training sessions later, they announced the squad for the London Paralympics. I was a practice dummy at that point. But seeing those guys lead up to that point in their career, and then obviously what happened in London in 2012, you know, it was a stinger. But a large amount of guys retired after that. I mean, Chance, Scott, Seth, Will, Springer, for a little while. I mean, a lot of guys retired. After that, I think the first tournament we went to was in Denmark. And Dave, I think you were there. And then Australia, and then we had a Lakeshore Challenge after that. But that was when we had 21 guys on the team at that time, I think. Wow. And, you know, it was cutthroat. Obviously, you're fighting for your position. I kind of got thrown into a mental cyclone at that point of my career is when they put me in a low point chair. I don't know if you guys remember that, but I was playing in Landon Groff's chair, low point chair, and playing in a chair that didn't fit me, trying to change everything I've learned. And then, you know, one session I'm in a low point chair, the next session I'm in a high point chair. That was tough. That was really hard to adjust to. But yeah.
I do know that your mentor, Will, he started that.
Yeah, he did, but he's way better than me.
Well, you're playing the two role, right?
Yeah, the two role. Or the one four role. Deuce lineup. Yeah, the four deuce lineup with me in a low point chair, sometimes me and Ernie in a low point chair in the same lineup. You know, going to Australia and finally getting into the game, playing against, you know, Riley Batt for the first time was, you know, amazing experience. Obviously, where we played at in Australia. downtown Sydney, outside. First time the sport's ever been played outside, I think. Broadcast by Fox at the base of a cathedral church. I mean, what a cool place to play rugby. But yeah, the low point here was tough. Obviously, just trying to get accustomed to it.
Let me spin this a little positively. Because I feel bad where we're at, because it's like I've never seen you in a low point chair, and I've seen folks like even 1.5s in high point chairs, and that just messes with your head trying to figure out your role and everything. But talking about like playing in Australia outdoors with people watching, like, is it something you'd like to see more of? Is it something you'd participate in? Is it something that, like, we should do in the United States? I'm just thinking, because it's like,
yeah,
you talk about it like it was a really positive thing, and it sounds like there were people involved and, like, just walking up to it and just be like...
Wasn't it wet, too?
The morning game, I think, still had dew on the courts. No, it was an extremely positive... event. You know, we obviously knew going ahead of time that we had to play outside, but you know, guys were putting, you know, the black underneath their eyes. Guys are playing in sunglasses. I mean, it's Australia, it's beautiful and sunny. The hardest part was finding, you know, what they had to come across was a court. They pieced together a court, so every transition that the court slid together, you know, was a lip. And if you bounce the ball on that lip or bounce the ball in the middle of the court, you know, it could be hard or it could be, you know, dead ball. I mean, it would, it bounced differently. I think it'd be a great thing if we encouraged that more, here in the United States. it's just fun. You're playing outside. The sound is different. The ability to, you know, talk back and forth to your teammates, and it's a whole different experience. Especially playing in a huge crowd in a downtown city. I mean, you got people walking up, you know, seeing these huge big screen TVs and seeing wheelchairs flip over. I mean, it was a good event.
Did you talk to any of the, like, locals? Like, did they come up to you and ask you about the sport?
We didn't get out a whole lot to, you know, when you're with the team like that, you travel with the team, you're on the bus to the hotel, back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, we got out and did a little bit of pushing, went to the mall, you know, the bridge down there. Sydney at night was absolutely gorgeous. So, you know, became pretty good friends with the Australian team at that point. Got to know a lot of guys. But as far as the locals know, it was, I didn't get enough time for that. But
yeah. I was just curious.
Besides obviously there's a great deal of honor in playing for Team USA. There's a lot of pageantry. Obviously you have pride in winning a gold medal. But how does that compare to your trip to Russia as a rugby ambassador?
Mm-hmm. You know, being on the USA team, kind of what you just said, Dave, you take that with pride, put on the USA jersey. It's exciting. There's no other feeling like it. But you're there to win. I mean, that was our goal every time we went. And we did. That 2.5 years I was on the squad, I don't think we lost at all. I mean, we cleaned house. It was a lot of fun. But when I got asked to go to Russia as a diplomat for to Lakeshore, the Russian club ball team, we were there to help them get developed, but also they looked at us like superheroes. I mean, they'd never seen anybody from the United States, let alone anywhere else outside of Europe. So to them, we were superstars coming to their court hometown, and that was really
not only that, cool. You guys were outdoors and you're doing athletic things. They probably, in many cases, they were kind of shut in, weren't they?
Some of the guys, yeah. I mean, I got to know one guy really well, and he lived on the third story of an apartment, and he never left his apartment. He crawled down the stairs and brought his chair down with him up and down, and that was his only outing was rugby. So, you know, obviously what they have to go through in Moscow and in Russia, let alone the hardships that they've seen. It was a big eye-opener, for sure.
How long was that trip?
It was 10 days, I think.
Was it all rugby, or did you do some, like, sightseeing and exploring?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Scott Hogsett, Emily, Shyrock, Bob Lujano, Odie, me, Gabe Nurkinen, and Mitch and Carolyn went on that trip. And you know, at first, it was rugby, getting to know the Russian team. I think there's a couple of teams in Russia actually, but we got to know the Moscow team, the best. And they took us to their court where they practiced. Scott Hogsett, you know, was the head coach role, and, tried teaching them specific rules and different, ways to play the game, kind of what he does in Phoenix, obviously. Trying to teach them some things, and did a really good job at doing that. Tried to instill some good practice techniques for them to utilize. But then, yeah, we got to go do a little bit of sightseeing. Went to the op, downtown Moscow for a couple nights. They took us, I guess in Moscow, they take everybody. They want to show you the outside of the city because it's pretty congested in downtown Moscow. But they go outside into the country, and they have little farms as their vacation homes. And they took us 3.5 hours north to this little retreat and wined and dined us. It was a lot of fun. It was a good time.
Awesome.
But I'll share one experience in Russia. I wrote this down to share with you. It was a small high school, and they took us into this suburban area that looked like it hasn't been touched since the Cold War. Even the grass no one mows the grass over there. They took us to this very, very shady looking school, and they pushed us around out back. I mean, it looked like we were going there to stay, if you can imagine. They lift us up into the gym, and the gym is full of high school students ready to watch us play the Russia team. And we literally had 5 minutes to tape up. I played without taping up my arms or putting arm sleeves on. And probably a 20-foot banner of Putin every wall. So it was, you know, it was a crazy experience. But I was pretty fortunate to be able to do that.
Say, Dave, that sounds a little bit like that experience in front of the kids in Columbia. Do you remember that?
You know, there the –
It was a school, I think. Dave and I played on a team in Columbia, and it was sort of similar. I think we had more than 5 minutes to get ready, but it was crazy. The floor, the crowd was so loud that the floor was shaking.
I think that's what's cool about the international experience is that you don't know what you're getting into, like who you're going to see, who's going to see you, how they're going to perceive you, how you're going to think of them.
Yeah.
And you just get out there and like, I mean, I've traveled with everyone except for you, Eric.
Yeah.
But, I would love to get back out there again. Not just locally, but afar. But I remember just like, how do we talk about this? Like, how do we act on the court and how do we interact with the other players? Because you're there to compete, but you're also there as an ambassador of your country, your entire country.
And a mentor, right? We're also trying to teach them something. People that are, you know, a lot of times we're there trying to help them improve their game.
Yeah.
Not just go over there and either, you know, beat them up or get beat up by whoever, but there's a lot more going on. But we are ambassadors. I mean, the first time I went to Colombia, everybody told me they hate Americans because they don't know anything about us, just like we only know cocaine and drug cartels about Colombia.
Yeah.
So I had to be their first real interaction with an American. Sorry, everyone. But, you know, it was really interesting, and I was surprised at the weight of it. But when you really dig down and see that people have the same exact concerns and wants and needs, they're no different than we are. And mm-hmm. once you get to that point with somebody, then you can really start understanding them and have them understand you.
So whenever you go someplace like that, and Eric, going back to your Russia experience, like, how did you try and portray Americans? Like, how did you, like, because everyone's got, like, an idea of, like, say you're going to a new school. It's like, this is who I'm going to be. It's like, I'm going to be the cool kid, or I'm going to be a little quieter here, or I'm going to be this kind of an American. I'm going to...
Especially when you work in with all the different personalities that were with you, right?
Yeah.
You got Bob Luano, you got Ogsett, you got Emily, Odie. I mean, go down the list. Mm-hmm. What did you see as your role, and what? How did you do that? Like, tie off of what Mike said here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. I guess I consider myself as – I put myself in the role of finding different players after you watch a scrimmage or play a scrimmage against Russians. You pick out a couple of players that see that have some really good potential and some players that have some good determination on their face and maybe are chirping back and forth and talking a lot. You pick out some positive traits in different athletes. And it was tough because they didn't speak any English. There was only one guy that did. And so that was really hard to get different terminology and kind of give them some encouragement and tell them what they're doing good and what they're doing bad. So I tried to pick different players and, you know, pull them aside and bring our interpreter with us and just give them a little bit of feedback. Whereas, you know, they didn't even have a coach with them. They were just teaching themselves. You know, you got Emily there obviously they'd never seen a woman probably play wheelchair rugby, and you know, they couldn't believe how fast she was and taking hits and flipping over and getting right back up. I mean, we all know Emily, obviously. And then, you know, Odie with the speed, and Scott and Gabe teaching the low pointers some solid new things to encourage and coach, you know, their highly dominant high pointers that they had. I mean, they had a guy from Serbia who was a triple amp, got ran over by a train similar to Josh. And, you know, still good Facebook friends with him. And you can see he's still not only dominating rugby, but swimming and different things he's taken on. So it's neat to see.
That's awesome, man. So what did you take away from it? Like, so I see all the things that you gave them. You gave them a role model. You showed them, you know, high pointers, low pointers, female athletes, with the Odoms, like their relationship that they, they were talking about, and all these different things. But I mean, how did it change your life? I mean, 'cause was that your first time? I mean, it was your only time really with an opportunity like that. That's just really cool.
Yeah. It really has never happened that I know of. Especially to go to Russia. I guess what I took away from it is to become more humble. Those guys are living in different situations. You know, I don't know what their home life is, but you know, Moscow in Russia is a huge country, and to find and also to see the hospitals that they stayed in. Mm. I mean, literally, they were trying to showcase their hospitals to us that this is top of the line for their athletes and for their recovering spinal cord patients. And their hospital equipment and their everything that they used for recovery looked like what ours did in the United States probably back in the 60s and 70s. Things didn't, I mean, it's so far behind. So I just became trying to become more humble, I suppose, after seeing what they all went through and how they've came together, and their camaraderie too. That was really fun to see. I watched a couple tournaments after going to Russia, and I mean, you could tell some of those guys were utilizing some of the things that we taught them. So that was really fun.
Yeah.
To watch.
How often do you get to see the Russian athletes like play? Like, 'cause I've seen like the German teams, the Polish teams, but I've never seen like Russia play. I mean, are they continuing to develop their program? Is it something that's like back burner maybe? Like, where are they going?
Yeah. No, they played in a tournament in the European Nationals back in 14 or 15 or 16. I can't recall, but you know, they were close to qualifying. I just don't think they've got a real, funding leadership role that's, you know, recruiting and developing athletes. I guess I'm not really sure where they're at and where they rank.
Well, nobody's anywhere right now.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Really, kind of shift gears here. What the heck happens internationally now that Japan's canceled or postponed, right? We don't know for sure if it's what happens going forward? What do you guys think? When do we start again? When does international rugby, you know, I heard Team USA is looking to do, to try to do camp.
I think the 21 Olympics is now in jeopardy. I don't see how they're going to pull it off. I mean, it's still a year away, but.
Well, I'm looking at, okay, let's say that USA doesn't have a USWRA season to draw on. Right. So they don't have new players that have been classified. They don't get that kind of constant play and training. They're going to have to train on their own. Are they able to be prepared for Japan? And what countries are we going to compete against that have been able to do that because they're in better shape?
Yeah. Right. I mean, because Australia, Japan, they're training. I don't know about GB.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, I mean, so I think the benefit is that a lot of the folks that are on the USA squad right now, it hasn't turned over completely in a while. And so at least there's some chemistry already. It's like, you know that if Josh Wheeler chucks it up, that Chuck will be under there and bringing it home. You know, those low pointers are ridiculously smart and have worked really well with their high pointers for a long time. You hope that this could be one of those things where it comes together. But, dude.
Well, Eric and Chris, you guys know this better than either of us. You train toward a date and an event, right? You're training toward Tokyo, and then it gets postponed a year. Yes. I got you. Right, you've put a lot into that, and now you've got another year of waiting and kind of ramping your training down some, but you've got a peak again. How does that affect you physically, mentally? Is it what's the challenge?
You go first, Eric.
I would say this is going to be harder on those guys mentally than physically. They're going to get back in their chairs. They're going to tape up, strap up, and go back into the lineups that they originally had. And you're going to see probably just a small drop off in play. Unless, you know, I start thinking about this, Dave, as you start talking. Unless Gumby or anybody else throws, you know, a fire inside it to recreate the game that they knew leading up to this point. I think physically they'll be fine. Those guys are solid. Mentally, I think going through the motions at home, going through the motions, getting your reps in at the gym and forcing yourself, keeping yourself accountable. I would see that being the hardest part. You know, I've watched and talked to a couple of the guys doing Zoom talks, watching video. I mean, it's going to get old by doing that over and over and over again. They're gearing up to strap in and play against each other. You know, the only thing I could think about it is they might possibly be too anxious, you know, overcommit on a push or a pass or a play because they're too excited. They're really going to have to hone it in and get back to what they do best is win. And
I worry about the mental more on the training aspect, right?
Yeah.
You know, you people say it, that you have to love the grind. But at some point, the grind without the release of the competition has got to be really draining. I would, you know, I'm not the guy that likes the grind. So, you know, from my perspective, it seems like that would be really challenging.
Mm-hmm. I was talking about it with my squad this morning. We're trying something where we're getting together weekly that if we can't be together in person, we're talking and going over tape and going over strategy and stuff. And I think these guys are stuck. Like, and I'm not just talking about my team. I'm talking about across the country that, you know, what do when you don't see light at the end of the tunnel? Because, like, we thought this was going to be like a 3-month thing. It's not. And it's like, how do you get folks to grind on their own or do review on their own or just do something to keep themselves mentally okay? And I mean, so slight segue, what have you been doing to keep yourself okay during this time?
I guess I'll go back to March. I mean, lived with my parents for about a month because my wife was working in the hospital, didn't know what was going to happen, whether she's going to bring anything home. Went back home and I started doing a little bit more weightlifting, trying to rekindle old hobbies that I had before rugby. We built a house last year, so a lot of house projects. I mean, so that's going to keep me busy. So, and the family, you know, I got 2 kids. So I've been more or less, you know, I miss rugby, but it has been the last couple of years, my club ball team, we've been taking breaks after, you know, the second half of the season, just because of our head count or guys didn't qualify, or we just didn't commit to making it to nationals. But I found different ways, obviously, just in my own personal little bubble to keep me active and stay focused. You know, obviously with a bit more talk of rugby coming, it's got me more excited. I'm training a little bit more and doing my equipment check. I guess that's a challenge I propose to people that are just sitting around, you know, waiting, you know. Review your equipment. Get new spoke guards. Change your bearings. Things that you should be doing. Don't wait until middle of the season or the night before the game to do these things. So,
or until you're out on the trail and your footrest is dragging on the pavement.
Yep, that happens.
I only say that because it happened to me a couple of weeks ago.
So, like, how about this? What about with your team? How are you getting these guys engaged? Because you're a player coach, right? You guys don't have any ABs that you suckered into coaching you guys. How is it getting these guys to be okay? And, you know, I mean, because you're telling them to, like, check on these things, but are you guys doing any, like, talks on Zoom? Are you guys, you know, sending love letters to each other? Are you reminding Dave that you're in charge every now and then? Just,
you know, I guess I kind of regret not doing more for my team. I look back when all this went down, and I feel like I just kind of shut it all off. I didn't reach out to anybody. I just did my own thing. I think we all were doing that, regardless.
Pretty much.
Ralph, yeah, it's true. But I feel like I should have done more for my guys. We only have, I think, 7 on our team, and obviously that's manageable as a coach, but I guess I should have done more looking back. But, you know, we've done we're on a group chat. We text, every other week. We've done a couple of Zoom calls. We've got together and pushed. Looking to do that again. Keeping each other accountable. You know, a lot of my guys are looking to get new chairs right now. I'm applying for grants. Okay. So I'm kind of helping out with that. But I got to give it to my guys. They're all either their fathers or they are full-time employees somewhere. They got their own life. You know, rugby is definitely a passion that they all have. But they definitely have their plates full elsewhere. So, you know, it's...
It kind of sounds like you have a bunch of grown-ups on your team or something.
Yeah.
I think that's such a good thing, and that's such a challenge at the same time, because it's like, it's a good thing because that's what the sport's there for. It's supposed to give you like the social support, the psych support. It's supposed to give you role models. It's supposed to, I mean, I give examples of like, you or Dave or Dan Sauber is another guy, yep. Or Nick Fawn, or guys. I mean, these are obviously favorites of mine, but these are all folks that have their lives together, you know, having kids and having jobs and stuff. And how do you manage rugby at the same time? And I mean, I think it's a cool problem to have that people are obviously doing something right. But yeah, I just wonder like psychologically, like how people are dealing with it, because during the last few like board meetings or during conversations with the COVID task force, like we're trying to figure out how to help people, because you can see like, I wouldn't call them cries for help, but moments of frustration and distaste for the scenario we're in right now, and just wanting to get back to doing the things we love, and that's rugby. Yeah. And that's hard.
No, I think with rugby, when you're doing it full time, you've got a something to focus on, obviously. And when you don't have that focus, whether it be rugby or a hobby, or, you know, you're laid off of work or you're not working, or and then everything else is going on in our world feeding you information, it's hard not to go crazy in a certain way. Because if you have always that focus, when's the next practice? When am I going to push with this guy? When am I watching video with this person? Or, you know, you're gearing up to that next big tournament. Yeah. We don't have that right now. So we're kind of just treading water, waiting for land to show. I don't know. I live in a little bubble out in the middle of nowhere. So I guess I've been, I've been doing everything with family and a little bit with friends here and there, but definitely anxious to get back with my team. And we're a good group of guys to, obviously with every team, you have a lot of fun with each other. So,
yeah, I think that, and this is what I told my squad this morning, is that it's about structure, it's about ritual, it's about repetitions. It's having that structure in your life where you've got things that you're going to do at a certain time, because if you're given free time, people don't do well with that.
Yeah.
And especially with a sport that relies on some certain type A personalities to, work hard and always be driven and focus on the details. That's a huge challenge to, to create that structure out of nothing.
Yep.
So,
and for the guys that are amping up and getting ready for the next trial, those guys obviously have a huge plate that they've got to be working on. With several USA guys probably nearing retirement. Who's going to fill their shoes? I mean, there's a bunch of guys that are looking to take those guys' next spot in the USQRA. So, mentally for them right now, you put it off, but it takes a long time to peak at that point when it's necessary. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It's tough.
No, it's kind of cool to look at, going on Instagram every now and then and on Facebook and seeing people that are, on their own doing their grind, the Ernie Chuns of the world who are up at 4:30, pushing three marathons and lifting up Buicks in his garage or something. But it's like, not everyone is built like that with that that mentality. So
yep.
I don't know. It takes a very special person to stay okay and stay right at a time like this.
That one of the things that we talked about the other night when the board got together is what can we do as a league to try to help players out there who rugby is a real important component of their self-worth and their purpose and their social outlet and everything else. How do we do that? And I think that it's really important. How do we help people who have found this thing in their life that makes it so much better, and now they've had it ripped away from them for this phantom illness that, I've talked to too many players that have had it and had serious things, or that have had it and not had serious things, or that think they had it sometime in November but didn't get tested.
Stop it.
But they took some vitamin C, so they're fine.
Be right? Nice, Dave. Be nice. I'm
just talking in general terms. it's a big hole in our lives,
yeah.
And we all want to get back to it. I am dying to play, but I'm not ready to die to play, and I'm not ready to have long-term heart and lung issues. The chances just seem high to me, but that doesn't mean that somebody else might want to play. I just know that I personally probably won't be playing soon. We talk about players.
Yeah.
But I spoke with a player this week who contracted COVID-19. His father also contracted COVID-19, and his wife and another relative. His father passed away. This was within the last month. And while I think he knows that he's not responsible for that, he will for the rest of his life have guilt, feeling like I may have contributed to this. What if he got it from me? And his words to me were, I don't want any other person to ever go through what I'm going through right now.
Yeah.
And that shook me to my core.
right? I'm hearing people, there's a guy I know who got it in March before we even locked down, lives in New York, he's in the publishing industry. He still to this day has heart and lung problems. They treat him as if he has COPD. And he was very healthy, ran, eats really well. He has no reason to be concerned that he is on the list of people who should be concerned.
Yeah.
Darwin is not in play here. If you're the person that makes the wrong decision, it doesn't mean you're going to have the consequence. And that's, you know, if we could just say, you know, if you're going to take a risk and it's you who suffers for it, then that's your decision. But that's not the case. It's not you who necessarily is going to suffer for your decisions. Mm-hmm. We've all changed our lives significantly. When this first started happening, and those of us who took it extremely seriously, we've relaxed some of the things that we've been doing. Part of it because the information is better, and part of it because we're just friggin' sick of it.
Yeah, but I took a teaching position about a month ago, and my eyes are on fire every day because I'm on a screen now, like about 12 hours a day. And you guys probably deal with this too. But the bottom line is, had I considered all that, I might not have taken a position because it gives me headaches and it's just, everything's different. And I was thinking about rugby. I don't even know if we can get gyms to play in, frankly, at least not out here. Nobody's willing to take that chance.
Yeah.
Well, and if you have a big sponsor, they're not ready to take that chance either. Mm-mm. You know, you look at your teams that are sponsored by hospitals or rehab centers, I don't see them playing anytime soon, especially if they're in a place that got hit like New York or California or Michigan or Illinois. It's not going to happen. Mike, what's your team's – are they allowing you to get together for any reason? Are they allowing you to schedule anything?
No, we're not doing a thing. It's like we're the least likely team to start playing right away.
You know, we talked about taking down the nets and some public and private tennis courts and playing some outdoor ball. And we could probably pull that off until you know, it's really rainy or snowy. But I don't know. It's just talk. We don't really have a game plan.
Well, we're not a team.
What about you, Eric?
We don't usually do much in the summer. We'll get together once a month. And I think, you know, when we were talking earlier about what Eric does, coach for this, we knew going into the summer that we probably weren't starting in September. So there was no rush for us to do anything. And because we don't have any budget or anybody to film games, we don't even have game film. Like, I've asked other people for a film of us. And I can't get it. I mean, I'd be happy.
Sorry.
To take a film of this decade. You have some, Mike?
I don't. I have it from a few years ago, but I think I deleted it.
It doesn't help me.
I know.
You know, you look at our young guys like Jason. God, there is so much I would like to be able to show him, but he needs to see himself succeed and fail in those videos to really get what I'm trying to tell him. I mean, you know, I can tell him it on the court and he hears me, and sometimes he reacts and sometimes he doesn't, but it's a totally different thing when you can see that, so... You know, we're just going to have to.
I mean, here's the video. In a big picture, I mean, we all know how fast time goes. As I look at it, as developing athletes, you know, for the future, whether it's for their club team or if USA Ball is their goal, as coaches, I think we all should be doing something to encourage their activity levels just to keep them in shape as a quadriplegic, to keep them healthy at this time. But also, you know, if you're gearing up to try out at the next tryout, you know, who are you talking to? Who's your mentor at this time of your life right now? Who's pushing you to go outside your boundaries to get you prepared? Like Dave said about Jason, you know, an up and coming high pointer, you know, repetition and see himself in these situations. But as we all know, it takes a long time to get to that point in our career anyways. It just sucks. We all want to play 1 year, but I don't know. I guess that's my little input. But
I'm going to throw some sunshine at this COVID fire. And
do it.
I'm going to ask you, who's your favorite player to coach and who's your least favorite player to coach?
Talking to me?
No, Chris, I already don't care about that.
I think Chris has both of his on this call.
Yeah, I think both of these are right here. Eric, I love you, but you suck. I hated coaching. Dave, you're my favorite. Okay. Kidding.
All right.
Do you remember the game where you told me today we're going to try and play no turnover rugby? I was there for you.
Oh. You me or Eric?
You.
Okay.
I remember when you inbounded to yourself too, Dave.
Let's not get it.
I do remember that. I remember that.
No, that's not true. I didn't inbound at all.
Then you asked the ref why it was a turnover.
Yes, I did.
And then he took
that was in
because I held the ball when I went out of bounds. I looked up at the referee, and instead of giving the ball back and forth, he said, "Yeah, you're okay." And so I pushed onto the court, and I got into the key, and I went and jammed in the key, and I was going to score, and then I hear the whistle, and I look back, and I was like, "What did I do wrong?" But I never threw the ball in, so
just one step you missed.
It happens.
That's hilarious
to me.
I think I was on the sideline looking like, what's he doing?
So let's, Eric, you want to answer
Eric,
the question?
I have a question.
Yeah. My favorite person to coach from my experience is probably Adam Kavanaugh.
I knew it.
Our 1-5 from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
The dude is, I don't know his disability, but he's got impairment in all four limbs. His hands will look like pancakes. But the dude is
tooth MVS.
Yes.
I don't remember the exact thing, but he talked about his Cliff Chun clone. Because
What
class is he?
1-5.
It's a 1-5 now. Start off as a 2, but the man can catch on to the game and do what you're asking from him. And he's the type of guy that when he looks at you, you know you're going to get output from him. He's going to produce something for you in his role. Whether we are down, whether we are up, he's always out there to learn. And he's a good friend on and off the court. Love the guy. I can't tell who's bad.
Can we just assume?
No, I'm not going to. You're challenging Dave, but you're not. I won't say my worst because you helped me out a lot too. But it's. I guess in my perspective, trying to play at a high level of rugby during club ball season, there's certain games. Obviously, you're putting your players out there to learn something. Maybe they won't get a lot of playing time in the next 2 games, so you're going to put them in and get them the experience and reps that they deserve. Hard thing for me is teaching and coaching people that are just out there just to go up and down the court, have a good time. And I get their perspective and I relate to them in that way. But, when we're out there in a tight knit game, and I'm demanding you to do something, especially being a player coach, one of the hardest things to do is keep my mind in the game while I'm trying to perform at my best. That's extremely hard, as we all know. I can't pick out a player. That's been my challenge. But I guess people that don't have that mental drive in really tight circumstances to play their role and do it how we practiced. There's certain scenarios that it's laid out right in front of them. I tell them what to do, and they go rogue and try to do something else. Maybe what they saw. And I respect that because they've
you are talking about
But you know what? In those tight situations, you've seen something different, and I respect it because that's how rugby is. It's a split second reactions that we all have to take. So,
Eric, when you're on the court and you're the coach, in the heat of a moment, like when things are, it's crunch time. Are you pretty vocal, or you just kind of let the game come to the players, or what's your role there?
I'm very vocal before really tough games. I demand a lot out of my athletes, be in their chair and taped up by a certain time and pushing to get warmed up, you know, getting all the dust brushed off their shoulders. It's super important before a game. When that game starts, I go silent. I'm doing my thing. When there's times that I need to speak up, you know, I'm definitely chatting and chirping in guys' ears as I'm going to score the goal, as I'm letting the clock tick down. You know, I demand a lot out of my bench too, to help me. But as a coach and a player, you know, obviously I'm getting older. I'm training not as much as I used to. I get tired. When I get tired, I don't necessarily talk and coach my team like the way I should. So a lot of time I just demand the experience and the respect out of my teammates to step up.
Sometimes when you come off the court in an intense situation and you're not sure what to do, when you're thinking about your own role, you, rather than saying something, allow your teammates to talk and hear what they have to say. And I think that, especially as being a player coach, because you also, you know, when you're on the floor, you can't think about what's going on the bench and what's going on around me as much as, you know, court awareness and what these guys are doing. But I think it's a lot harder because I had to do that too. But I feel like you're good at sometimes just sitting back, and even when it's a difficult situation, instead of just coming onto the bench and start yelling at people, you listen to what other people have to say, both from the sidelines and from on the court, so that we can kind of put together what everybody's seeing, and then you can take that direction and put a plan in place, and then we move forward.
So. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we've seen that in our last tournament, didn't we? I mean, I was off trying to dump a gallon of water in my head, and you guys were talking and came up with a plan and filled me in, and we were off to the race.
That last game, it was a tight game, and we were against Grand Rapids, and I almost put myself in a dozen times because I felt like you needed something different and that Jason's inexperience was hurting us. But then he would make a play that was speed related that I could never make, and you weren't looking for me to come in. And I wasn't going to second guess you as a coach, but I think, you know, one of the best games you've ever coached was when we played Grand Rapids in Grand Rapids. And that was one of those situations where I think you felt like you needed to do something, but you weren't sure what it was. And you just kind of absorbed what we had to say. And then you just kind of collected it all and said, all right, here's what we're going to do. And we went.
Yeah.
And that game turned over on aggressive play. Stopping and turning chairs and just, you know, playing good fundamental rugby and taking advantage of the mistakes that they made because we were doing so.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. You know, I look at those situations in club ball, and then I transfer that over to, you know, the next level. I'm going to use USA as an example. They all have their lines and they all know who's getting subbed in. Every 2 to 4, maybe 6 minutes at the most, and they're throwing another line out. Let's say there's a timeout in those situations. You know, they come back, and obviously they're focused on their head coach and assistant coaches on telling them what they need to adjust and change, but they don't have any time, those athletes don't, to sit and talk on what do you see, how should we do this better, or, you know, I hope to see that more in the future, instead of just one person hollering at everybody. You know, it's a team game. We're all we can't do anything. You know, you can't do it without your low pointers. I can't do it without my high pointers. I mean, we all rely on each other. So, yeah.
Amen.
This year, I got back on the court, and well, actually now, and you know, we had a high pointer, elite import, Matt Lewis from Australia. There was room for a zero to actually have an impact. So I trained and got back on the court. But in our last game, we're playing Phoenix B, and Hogshead was coaching. By the way, he's as good as there is out there as being a player coach, in my opinion. And, well, except now Chad Cohen's good too. They're both really good. And I said, I can't do both of these and do them well. And so I stood it up. But they beat us by like 8 in full play. And we had a little powwow about it. And I just sat out the second game. I was too good. But we had 4 guys. We were up on them the whole game by like 4. And it was such a different deal than the first game where I played and tried to do both. And the second game I just coached. And we went Iron Man, and our 4 guys, we won. And Scott said to me, we're going through the line, and he goes, well, I was waiting for you to stop. What happened? I said, it wasn't broke. We were going to try and fix it. And anyway, the bottom line is it's really difficult to do both at a high level. And those who can do it, I admire it, because it's just not easy.
So we should probably start wrapping up here, because we've taken a lot of your time today, Eric. Really appreciate having you around. So when it comes down to it, what is the best rugby advice you've received in the last decade that really framed how you approach the game, how you interact with others, how you approach sports in general? What's made the biggest difference in your life as an athlete?
Probably 2 things. Becoming prepared off the court. None of us can show up and tape up, strap in, and play at an elite level if that's your goal. I tell a lot of people, and I don't know who's told me this, maybe I've came up with it myself, but it takes on average 2 to 3 years of your body morphing into the rugby chair and into the game. It was really hard for me to see highly functional athletes, whether it's basketball players or people, with tons of function, jump into a chair and take a lot of guys' spots that have been working their ass off to try to get to that point. Putting in the hours, putting in the video, but also getting your body prepared. That was my hardest and challenging thing that I had to overcome, was up here telling my body and my shoulders what to do. And sometimes you just get that mental break where you hit the wall. You can hit that wall in certain games, but you can push over it with encouragement and being prepared before that game even starts. And equipment. Next thing is equipment. A lot of guys have been, what is really cool is you see experienced athletes. And I think one of your guys, Mike, blonde hair guy,
Marty.
I forgot his name. Marty, yes.
Yeah.
Seeing that spark in his eye after he jumped in my chair for that first time, yeah. Sitting in a chair that actually fit him. I mean, how cool is that?
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, things like that. Equipment is huge. And obviously, we all know that, but that's something that we all need to encourage people to tap into funding grants, take care of themselves, because if they want to compete, and to travel and to be their best, they can't be pushing around, you know, in a 6-year-old chair anymore. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's my little input on my growth as an athlete, just becoming more prepared. And it just takes a long time. I mean, I think this is year 12 for me. And, I really didn't become the athlete who I really wanted to be until I actually got cut from Team USA, playing with that chip on your shoulder, traveling with the Renegades team, then back into my own club ball team. That's probably when I played my best rugby, is those couple years, because I came back with a lot of experience and my body finally fit my chair. So
cool.
And you had something to prove.
Yeah, for sure.
Good thought. Yeah, yeah, good thought.
All right, well,
thanks, guys.
Eric, thank you so much. Seriously, it's been great. Miss seeing you every few weeks.
Sure. thank you guys very much. This was a lot of fun.
Good yeah.
catching up with you.
Really appreciate it, Eric. Thanks a lot.
Say hi to the fam, yep. Okay?
Will do.
All right, take care, bud.
Be safe.
Hey, bud. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.